You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 274, our 34th Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, finally another Q&A. It's about time. We're way overdue.
Yeah, we are way overdue. So, yep.
Yeah.
I have to own that.
Oh, yeah. And I want to apologize to everybody because at this point, we've got so many questions that, you know, it's just one of those deals that if I can't respond to you immediately or if at all, just know I got your questions and I have them in the queue. So just know that. So that's the best I can say as far as your chances of your question getting answered, because you know, we've got questions going back for 4 years, Mike, still. So I mean, we're just loaded. We could probably just do a whole
I don't know why you tell. Yeah, that makes me feel so good, Ray. Thanks for telling me that.
Yeah, you know, it's all right. You know, I mean, as many listeners we have, you know, everybody's reaching out. So it's just one of those deals that I can't respond to everybody. Mike can't respond to everybody, but we got your questions, and God willing, we'll come through all of them. I doubt it.
Yeah, well,
you know, keep sending
them. Yeah, I mean, and people should know, you know, people should know that, you know, part of the issue is, you know, we like to cluster things. We can get six or seven, you know, questions in an episode. I mean, that's good. But, you know, when you're asking thesis questions, well,
yeah,
that's not good.
Yeah, a lot of it.
We can't devote an episode to a whole, to just one question unless it, you know, in the past we've gotten a few that, you know, I look at and, yeah, that's an episode. Let's do that. But usually it's, you can't really do that.
Yeah. And we get lots of questions that are kind of the same topic. You know, they touch on the same issues. They're not worded exactly the same, but, you know, they're dealing with the same issue, or, you know, their thesis questions, or, you know, I mean, all of the above. So they're more statements than questions. Yeah. And I mean, it's just all of the above, but nonetheless, don't let that discourage you to send in me your questions still. Make them good, and we'll get there. And especially, just know I'm getting a lot of Exodus questions, Mike. So I'm saving those for our Exodus Q&A. So
yeah.
So know that if you have a specific Exodus question as we go through Exodus, send me that question, and I will put it on the list because chances increase. All right, Mike. Anything else? Anything new with you in the world?
No, nothing really.
No.
Well, you know, I guess I could. You know, I learned this morning of the passing of Grumpy Cat. I bring that up because my fantasy baseball team for the Naked Bible League are the Grumpy Cats, and I'm in last place. So there might be some relationship between that. I don't know what to think, but yeah. I'm sad either way.
Man, it's been around a long time. I remember Grumpy Cat. I really got everything started back in the day as far as the memes and the videos and stuff, but I don't know how we transition from Grumpy Cat to
the Bible. Q&A, but Naked Bible, Naked Bible League, Naked Bible Q&A. So there we go. Well, that's my lame attempt anyway.
I hear you. Well, let's just jump into these, Mike. We've got about six or seven questions, as always. And our first one's going to be from Philip. And he was reading Eusebius and came across this quote from Book 5, Chapter 2. "Thus then, at length, the terrestrial demons and the world rulers that haunt the air and the spiritual host of wickedness and the leader of them all in malice were regarded among all men as the greatest of gods. The memory also of those long dead came to be thought worthy of greater worship." End quote. It lists three types of beings that were worshipped as gods: Nephilim, spirits, watchers, and spiritual host of wickedness. What are these spiritual hosts of wickedness? Were they human kings? I think they may also be mentioned in 1 Timothy 4:1. If these are human kings, might Isaiah 14:9 be viewed as the Raphaim specifically, rather than the dead?
Well, it's hard to know sort of what direction to take here. You know, I look at this, a quote like this, and similar sources for the same time period. But on one hand, it does show a little bit that this notion of, you know, connecting the powers of darkness to the concept of gods, you know, has not been entirely beaten down in early church thinking. In other words, it has survived. The Old Testament worldview, you know, still, you know, leaks into it. And part of the reason why, you know, you get this survival, and I would also say, and the confusion that is sort of arising from the question, not necessarily the question itself, but just that arises from it, has to do with the Septuagint. So I don't think any of these that are mentioned here are human kings, because you'll see all of this kind of terminology, you know, world rulers. This is that's going to be a term that goes back into Paul's vocabulary of cosmic geography, which, you know, is consistent with the Old Testament worldview that, you know, these are, you know, some of these are the gods, others of these are, you know, disembodied spirits, you know, of the giant clans and all that stuff. All of them would have been referred to in the Old Testament thinking as Elohim. You know, again, Elohim is just a word you would use, an umbrella term you would use for a spiritual being. The confusion results, and well, actually the connection and the confusion results from what happens when we transition out of a Semitic, you know, an Israelite, an otherwise Semitic worldview, into the Hellenistic period, you know, when Greek takes over, because the Greek vocabulary is a bit different. Now, for those of you who either were at or saw the last, you know, the first, you know, Naked Bible Conference, my presentation there had to do with the Septuagint, in part this vocabulary of divine beings. And you also find this in the Angels book, and you'll also, when the Demons book comes out, you'll see more of it there. But in a nutshell, you know, I don't see specifically Nephilim spirits here in Eusebius's quote. They could be there if you're taking terrestrial demons as the demons of the Gospels. That might be a connection, but at the end of the day, we're not sure. We're not certain what Eusebius is exactly thinking, because his quotation illustrates, again, the problem of terminology. And that is the Greek word daimon, or its related daimonion, becomes the generic word for supernatural being of any type. Just like Elohim is in the Hebrew Bible, you would use Elohim if you're describing, you know, a resident of the spiritual world, whether it's a, you know, a deity figure like Baal, or the disembodied human dead for Samuel 28:13, you know, one of the sons of God put over the nations that, you know, becomes there's a rebellious relationship there that develops, a la Psalm 82. I mean, all of these would have been Elohim. And Elohim as a term itself does not differentiate. Those things have to be differentiated in hierarchy, or, you know, in some other way, by virtue of other things that are said about them. You don't get the differentiation arise from a term like Elohim. And the exact same thing is true in the Hellenistic world with daimon and daimonion. Those terms become generic. You could call anything in the spiritual world a daimon, good or evil. Divine or disembodied human dead. I mean, they're all daimon, okay? So you don't get the differentiation arising from the term. So it's not clear when we're reading a writer, you know, that has this term, you know, lurking around in the background, church fathers, for instance. It's hard to know how precise they're being or how imprecise they're being. It may not be possible to really figure that out. Now, the major source for this, if people want this information, and I can put this in the protected folder, is J.E. Rexine. That's R-E-X-I-N-E. And this may be available just generally on the internet. I'm not sure anymore. It's been a while since I've read this article. But the article is entitled Daimon in Classical Greek Literature. And it's from the Greek Orthodox Theological Review, Volume 30, Number 3, 1985, pages 335 to 361. So it's a lengthy article. And I mean, this essentially deals with this issue, how daimon is a very elastic term. It's an umbrella term. It can be a neutral term. It can be something precise or just sort of imprecise, just general. It's hard to know, you know, what writers, a given writer is thinking just by virtue of their use of this term. So I'm going to read a little bit about this from my Angels book. Again, this question sort of prompts, if I'm going to bring this up, I might as well share an excerpt here. I wrote this: ontological language, for example, spirits, is frequently employed and qualified with adjectives like evil spirits. There's your adjective, evil plus spirits, to describe demons, a term that is itself ontological. Demon you know, our word in English, demon, is actually a transliteration of the Greek daimon, or the related daimonion, which in classical Greek literature describes any supernatural being without regard to its disposition, could be good or evil. A daimon can be a god or a goddess, a lesser supernatural being, or even disembodied, the disembodied spirit of a human. Consequently, daimon is semantically akin to Hebrew Elohim. Gospel writers use daimon in combination with descriptive phrases like evil or unclean spirits. And so daimon, daimonion in the New Testament, nearly always points to a disembodied entity hostile to God. Now, I have a footnote here in Angels. There's one exception to this. The one exception is Acts 17:18, where Gentiles, Greeks, listening to Paul, opine, quote, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities, foreign daimonion," unquote. Now, the New Testament is silent itself on the origin of demons, and so we don't really necessarily know, you know, what the Greeks exactly were thinking here. But they're not thinking that Paul's preaching about demons. He's thinking about, or he's preaching about some foreign deity. And so there you would have daimon or daimonion, you know, used in a neutral or positive sense, not necessarily a negative sense. So again, that's the only exception to the fact that when you get the New Testament, you can have daimon or daimonion, and it's typically used with an adjective, evil or unclean or something like that. And so in the New Testament, daimon or daimonion becomes the word of choice for any entity hostile to God. And so if you're using the Septuagint as a New Testament writer, you're going to see daimon and daimonion used in the Septuagint translation for, you know, the range of things that Elohim in Hebrew would have covered. You can use you'll see the term used of, you know, the gods of the nations. You'll see the term used of, you know, the inhabitants of Sheol, the disembodied human dead. So again, it's really hard on the sort of on the other side when we get into the Hellenistic period and beyond, when people are using this kind of terminology. It's hard to know if they're trying to be precise or not, or if they care, or if they're even aware of it. And then that's certainly possible. They're just not aware of the nuancing that a Semitic worldview, you know, the Hebrew Bible would have given, you know, that would be contained in its pages. I'm going to quote a little bit here from the as yet published, yet to be published Demons book. I have a little section. The Septuagint use of Greek daimonion in Hebrew Bible translation. So I wrote here, the most significant observation with respect to Septuagint translation decisions is the use of daimonion. The lemma occurs 17 times, 9 of which are found in the apocryphal or deuterocanonical books of Tobit and Baruch. The related daimon is used once. Septuagint use of this lemma is an important factor in understanding how the demons of the Gospels were conflated, they get mixed, with the gods, Elim or Elohim, or B'nai Elim, B'nai Elohim, allotted to the nations at Babel, Deuteronomy 32:8-9. So for Hellenistic writers, they are using the same term for, you know, all of these things. And so therefore, the nuancing that you get in the Hebrew Bible is lost eventually. Back to my excerpt here. Later chapters will explain why Old Testament and later Jewish theology would distinguish between these two groups of divine beings. So again, there is a distinction both in the Old Testament and later, you know, Jewish thinking. But when you get to the Hellenistic literature, the Hellenistic period, when Greek becomes dominant, that starts to fade. It starts to become blurry. Let's see. Septuagint translators use daimonion in certain passages that speak of the sons of God allotted to the nations. And later New Testament authors use the same term for spirit entities that harm people. Consequently, two groups of sinister divine beings that have completely different origins in Old Testament and Second Temple Jewish thought get lumped together. While this conflation is unfortunate, the vocabulary, daimonion, is still quite serviceable. Greek daimon and daimonion broadly refer to a divine being, good or evil. It can also be used of divine beings at different places in the divine hierarchy of supernatural pecking order. And here I quote from the Rexine article I just referenced, so just this will give you a flavor of what's going on here. The word daimon reflects the dynamism of the Greek vocabulary operating throughout the various periods of Greek literature. There is, of course, no single English equivalent. It is a word of tremendous range and significance. It is a word more generalized and less personalized than theos, that would be God, you know, in Greek. An investigation of classical Greek literature would lead to the discovery of the following meanings for daimon. Number one, the use of the word to signify a god or goddess or individual gods and goddesses. This would be a rare use of the term. Number two, more frequently, we would find it used of the divine power. The Latin equivalent would be numen. This would signify a superhuman force, impersonal in itself, but regularly belonging to a person, a god of some kind. Number three, the power controlling the destiny of individuals and then one's fortune or lot could be a daimon. Number four, it could be further specialized as the good or evil genius of a person or family, like the spirit of a family. Number five, a more special use would reveal the daimones as titular deities, the souls of the men of the golden age of Hesiod. That would be your sort of sons of God, giants, turf. Number six, general spiritual or semi-divine creatures who are less than gods, but intermediate between gods and men. Number seven, finally, devil and bad spirit in the Christianized sense. Of course, this last is not classical usage. So that's the end of the Racine quote. So what we have again is a conflation here. And so if you go back to the question about Eusebius, you know, who's what, what's who, how can I align this with any particular Old Testament passage? Good luck with that. Again, because the terminology that's involved here is by nature broad and elastic. So there's really no way to determine exactly what Eusebius was thinking.
Mike, can you just keep reading your demons book since it won't be out for a while?
Okay. You know, see, we could have opened the podcast with that because the reason why the demons book keeps getting pushed back is now public. But I'm guessing most of our audience doesn't know it anyway, so maybe we should just skip that. But, okay. You know.
All right.
There's another book coming out that's pushing demons into 2020. Let's just leave it at that for now.
All right. Our next question is from Lance. How sure are we that the average Jewish person at the time of Jesus and shortly afterwards would be able to make the connections to the Tanakh and Second Temple literature that underlie both Jesus's and the apostles' teaching? In other words, how educated was the average Jew? Was there a difference between men and women in terms of educational level and exposure to text? Is it reasonable to assume that the average person had this context in their heads? Surely most people didn't go to any type of school, with only a few entering rabbinical schools, and most people only heard occasional readings of parts of the Tanakh without any exegesis thereof.
Well, you know, just a general statement here. Yeah, there would have been a distinction between men and women in this regard. You know, women would have had culturally less access to formal education. That's going to change, you know, in the Hellenistic and the Roman periods, you know, so they, you know, that circumstance at least would change a little bit. I mean, who knows, you know, how much they're going to be taking advantage of it, you know, speaking of women now, but it does change. But I would say more particularly here, someone didn't have to go to school to have learned the content of the Tanakh. Now, granted, if you were a scribe or a highly literate person, someone who maybe knew a scribe or had access to scrolls in some other way or whatever, which is usually going to be a wealthier person that doesn't have to spend most of their day out in the fields working and all that stuff. Well, yeah, then you're going to have access to reading material. You're going to be more literate. It also is partly dependent on your synagogue if you're Jewish. I mean, we assume, again, that all that's going on there is reading. Okay, that's not necessarily a coherent assumption. I mean, the content of the Tanakh in the synagogues, you will get it. There will be discussion. There will be interpretation. There will be, you know, conversation and debate and whatnot. You know, the rabbis aren't just going to go home and never talk to their congregants again. You know, people are going to have questions. They're going to ask. The rabbis will get into discussions. You'll have them over for a meal or something like that. I mean, it's not as cloistered and static as you might suppose. The Targums are going to be available as well. You know, when you go to the synagogue, you'd probably hear, you know, either both Hebrew and a Targum, or maybe the Targums. Again, it just depends on what the rabbis, the teachers in the place are using. You know, there's no mass printing of anything. So when the Targums are out there, they'd have to be circulated. Well, who has to be engaged in that process? The answer is your spiritual leadership. And that's probably going to vary, you know, in terms of what you're exposed to. when you bring the Septuagint into the picture, again, that's going to have, you know, contribute to having a bit wider of an exposure to content and how people are talking about the Tanakh and its content and, you know, what's in it. So I would say the situation is, in some respects, kind of similar to today, even though we have this knowledge explosion where you can go, you know, to any store or any bookstore in any town and get a Bible, granted. But just having access to the material doesn't mean people are taking the opportunity. So I think in many respects, we have a lot of people who may have a lot of Bible facts in their head, but they don't know how to connect dots. The ones that do know how to connect dots are going to get there either because their pastor models connecting dots for them. Maybe they listen to this podcast, they you know, read one of my books or something like that. But those are things that they do on their own. They have to take the initiative and have the motivation to do so. But you and I both know that it's true that the average Christian today is not going to know a lot of this stuff. And it isn't because of literacy, it's really because of motivation. So I why do I bring that up? Well, I bring that up because even if you don't have a lot of people either taking advantage of the access they do have or the access for some reason is limited, even though that's true, the connections are still legit. The connections are still the connections. What the New Testament writers are doing with the Old Testament is still what they're doing. That is another way of saying that even if people aren't learning it, doesn't make it untrue. I think we need to establish that fact. You know, there is a disconnect today, even if Christians, you know, are trying to, you know, do Bible study. There's quite a disconnect today between the way, you know, we'll call them the literate people, the academics, the scholars, look at Scripture, and the way that the person in the pew in the average church does. The fact that there's more people in the pew, there's exponentially more of them than there are scholars, does not make the less literate, less academic perspective about Scripture correct. Doesn't make it correct at all. So I don't think we should be connecting. I'm not saying that the questioner did this, but I think it's worth bringing up. We should not be connecting majority opinion or majority way of thinking or not thinking with correctness or accuracy. That would be a non sequitur conclusion to draw. Now, let's go back to a little bit back in the Colossians series. You might recall, again, if you've listened to the podcast for a good amount of time, we did an episode on Paul's signature at the end of Colossians. And I read some excerpts from a book and an article. See that what I've written with my own hand here. You recall from that episode that writing was the real sort of litmus test of the highly educated. Not so much reading, but writing. More people could read in Paul's day than could actually compose. And again, if you've ever, you know, taken a language like Greek or Hebrew, French, German, whatever, it is easier to read than it is to compose. I mean, it's a different level of knowledge about the language you're trying to acquire. So we need to keep that in mind. You know, just because, you know, we might, you know, presume that the literate class was small, the class that could actually read and maybe write real simple things, that's going to be wider. It's still a wider net. So I think that needs to be factored in here too. Now, there is a book called Ancient Literacy. If you're into this topic, you know, you might want to avail yourself of it, that I discovered, you know, by virtue of an article. I'm going to reference both the book. The book is Ancient Literacy by William V. Harris. It's a Harvard University Press title, 1989. And the article that I had that referenced this is by Roger McFarlane, Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, and Latin, subtitle, The Languages of the New Testament Judea. This is from Brigham Young University Studies, Volume 36, 1996. So it's an article about ancient literacy. So McFarlane, the author of the article, quotes Harris, and he says this, "The other documents that survive from the period of the Masada siege," and these are very simple letters, you know, names and stuff, "do not necessarily require extensive literacy on the part of their users, as most of these texts are brief and restricted to a single name or phrase or alphabetic character. You know, general literacy was probably no higher in Palestine or at Masada than in Hellenized cities of the Roman Empire, some of which may have achieved 20 to 30% literacy rates." Now, by our standards, that's a low literacy rate, 20 to 30%. But it's still a significant number, you know, of the population, even for, you know, a class that has very, very defined socioeconomic levels. Let's put it that way. And again, less formal education. So given the circumstances, that's a pretty decent rate, you know, of literacy within the overall population. But again, even if you're not literate, even if you're a slave or something like that, and you're in a church or you're in a synagogue or whatever the circumstance is that makes you not be literate, there's no way of knowing how much effort your spiritual leaders, your rabbis, for instance, are really putting forth to get you either to listen to them as they connect dots, or refer you to, maybe you can't read Hebrew, but you could read Aramaic, you know, to refer you to a Targum or a Septuagint or something like that. So a lot of this is dependent on your spiritual leadership. And within a family group, if you do have one person who is a reader, does that other person read to other people? There's really no way to quantify that. So, you know, it's a difficult question, but I don't think we're wise at all to connect the two things in terms of, well, most people wouldn't have been thinking this, so it can't be right. Again, that is a non sequitur conclusion to draw.
Our next question is from Becky from Massachusetts. The ESV reading of Deuteronomy 32:17 is, they sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. What is the significance of the phrase, new gods that had come recently, especially the recently part?
Okay. Well, I will focus on this in, you know, to answer the question, but it behooves me to say that the ESV is messed up as a translation at Deuteronomy 32:17. This is why you will never see me quote it in any public presentation of my content. It's also why I got a published journal article just on this verse in a journal called Bible Translator. Okay. And I believe that article is in the protected folder as well. But basically, they sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known. That is a self-contradiction within the verse. They can't be no gods and gods at the same time. The ESV messes this up. Probably because the translator, you know, maybe was afraid to potential polytheism or something silly like that. The phrase no gods there is, it's not Elohim. They sacrifice to demons, literally not to Eloah. That's a singular noun. It is always singular. And so in the Hebrew, there is no contradiction. They sacrifice to demons, not God. To gods they sacrificed that they had never known, to new gods that had come along recently. So ESV messes this up. Other translations get it right. ESV, this is sort of an anomaly within the translation. Anyway, let's move on to the actual question. The significance of the phrase new gods that had come recently. The reference here is to the Israelites' adoption of foreign gods subsequent to their covenantal relationship with Yahweh, which began with the patriarchs, you know, a few hundred years prior, and which was certified at Sinai. So the comment, if you think about it, is yet another retrospective assessment on the part of the writer of Deuteronomy, and is therefore likely not Mosaic. Think about it. When did the Israelites start going after other gods besides Yahweh? Well, that was after the era of Moses. It was after the conquest, you know, not too far after the conquest, because we learn from the book of Judges that they start to let the people live in the land, they start to intermarry, you know, all this kind of stuff. So that's when the problems begin. And we see the evidence of that in the book of Judges, but that's still post-Mosaic. So this is a retrospective comment that refers to gods that the Israelites, to sound like a prophet here, went a-whoring after subsequent to the God's covenantal relationship, Yahweh's covenantal relationship with the Israelites through the patriarchs and then during the time of Moses. So any gods the Israelites decided to follow subsequent to Yahweh, the God of their fathers, was a newbie. And that's what it's pointing to.
Our next question is from Eric from Pelican Rapids, Minnesota. I've enjoyed reading N.T. Wright, but one thing I can't wrap my head around is his discussions of the sacraments. I came from an American evangelical background, viewing them as ordinances, but I don't see anything in the New Testament that makes them more sacramental. Am I missing something, and or is there some Second Temple Hebrew or ancient Near Eastern context that makes the way other faith traditions talk about them coherent? Is Wright slipping into his own faith tradition here and not really sticking to the text?
Well, I would say, yeah, he is slipping into his own faith tradition, but he would say, you know, that he's interpreting the text, you know, correctly in a sacramental fashion. But, you know, to be honest with you, you know, I'm in agreement, you know, with you. I don't see anything sacramental about baptism or the Lord's Supper depending on what is meant. So a lot of evangelicals who are outside of sacramental contexts will only be hearing the word sacrament and thinking one sort of definitional way about that term, when there's actually more than one thing that could be meant by a term like sacrament. For example, you know, somebody might use the term sacrament and mean a ritual act like, you know, baptism or the Lord's Supper that contributes in some way to salvation. In other words, this ritual I'm doing is a sacrament in the sense that it contributes grace, saving grace to me or to the recipient. Okay, that's one way that sacramental terminology is used. And if you're outside, again, liturgical churches, the tendency is to make everything sound that way, like Roman Catholic or something like that. You know, some sort of other form of Christianity that you've been distanced from and may have had conversations about, and this kind of thing will leak out in the conversation, or maybe you read, you know, Catholic theology or whatever theology. So this is one way that sacrament is used, but it's not the only way. Someone else might use the term to speak of a ritual act or really any spiritual practice that assists us in sanctification. In other words, it's not about salvation. It's about sanctification. It's about growth as a Christian. Now, I'll use an example here from my own life. When I was in graduate school, and again, up until this point, I have been, you know, completely out of the, you know, out of church contexts that had any liturgy, you know, anything like this, So we attended a number of churches, you know, once we moved, you know, to Madison, and we wound up going to a Christian Reformed church that appealed to us for a bunch of different reasons. The gospel was clear there, but they used the sacramental language, okay? And so I would often ask questions. Now, the pastor at the church at the time, you know, told me, look, you know, we're not, you know, I don't use the word sacrament, and nobody else around here is going to use the word sacrament to say that if you do this thing, then that's going to contribute to your salvation or result in your salvation. I just remember a conversation at one point. He said, you know, the Lord's Supper is a sacrament like reading your Bible or praying is a sacrament. It's a thing that you do that helps in your growth as a Christian. It helps you become more of what you should be just as a believer. It's something God can use to assist you to become, you know, a better believer, think more Christianly, you know, however you want to put it. So it had nothing to do with, you know, salvation. So I want to use that as an illustration to say that it's kind of hard to know what anyone really means by the term sacrament unless you sit down and have a conversation with them and ask them to, what do you affirm by the term and what do you deny by the term? And I don't know exactly how Wright is using it. I don't think he would be using it in a soteriological sense, but I don't actually know that. So I don't really know exactly what he means. I personally avoid the term because for too many people out there, it smacks of earning merit in terms of salvation, even if that's not what's meant. And so I think the term is confusing. I think the term is potentially has a great potential to misdirect people or leave them in a misguided position, you know, intellectually, theologically, just in the way they're thinking. So I just avoid it.
All right. Nathan has a question. In Unseen Realm, Mike makes the point that the Hebrew of Genesis 6:1-4 doesn't necessitate marriage, wives, but could just be an illicit sexual relationship, women. The Greek in the Septuagint appears to be a literal translation of the Hebrew going into women. But in Matthew 24:37-38, Jesus clarifies this by saying, quote, marrying and giving in marriage, end quote. Where is Matthew getting this from? Enoch?
Yeah, I decided to take this question. You know, some people are already thinking, well, the answer to this question is on Mike's website, and it is. but I decided to take this one anyway because, you know, there's going to be a lot of people in the podcast audience that haven't looked at the website or don't search the website. So the premise of the question is flawed, and that's what's exposing this tension in the question. Matthew 24 has nothing to do with Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Matthew does not use the Septuagint of Genesis 6. He does not use the vocabulary that you'll find in Genesis 6. So it doesn't matter how, you know, literally, I mean, and it's a straightforward translation by the Septuagint translator, but that isn't the question. That doesn't matter. What matters is the question is, does Matthew use the vocabulary of Genesis 6? And he doesn't, which ought to tell us that he's not thinking of Genesis 6. He's also not thinking of Enoch. Again, you can go up and get more details on this from my homepage, you know, DRMS, just drmsh.com, put in Matthew 24, Genesis 6, and you're going to find this. But I'm going to read a little bit from that post. So from my homepage, there's another issue that goes along with this assumption. The other significant problem is that saying Matthew 24, 37 through 38 is about a repeat of Genesis 6, 1 through 4, then that requires you to ignore parts of what Matthew describes, or deliberately not to see the disconnections with Genesis 6, 1 through 4. So not only does Matthew not use the Septuagint of Genesis 6, 1 through 4, Matthew actually, in what he does say, there are things in what he does say that are not in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. And you can't just ignore that or not see it. So here's the full list of what Matthew says will be going on when Jesus returns that was going on in the days of Noah. Here's the list: eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, and not watching or, you know, otherwise being unaware. Okay? Only one of those, conceivably but incorrectly, could be associated with Genesis 6, 1 through 4, and that is the marrying and giving in marriage phrase. The others have no association whatsoever with the supernaturalist aspects of Genesis 6, 1 through 4, or even any of the content of Genesis 6, 1 through 4. So why impose the supernatural character of Genesis 6 onto what Matthew says? It's an arbitrary decision, and one made, I would say, incoherent and unsustainable by the lack of any direct connection to the Septuagint of Genesis 6, 1 through 4. So what I mean by that is, look, if Matthew was really thinking about Genesis 6, 1 through 4, A, he would use the vocabulary of the Septuagint for the marrying and giving in marriage, but he doesn't. These are different terms in Matthew than they are in the Septuagint of Genesis 6. Okay, so that would be the first thing Matthew would do. He would dip into the vocabulary to telegraph to his readers of what, you know, some Old Testament passage that he's thinking of. But that isn't there. So he would do that. And the second thing he would do, again, if I'm Matthew, this is what I would do. I would connect my vocabulary to what's in Genesis 6, 1 through 4 in Greek. And I would not, in my writing, list things that are not in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. So when Matthew starts adding things, that is another thing that tells you he's really not thinking about Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Rather, what he's thinking about is more general. He's thinking about people going about their normal lives. Okay, they're eating and drinking. They're marrying and giving in marriage. Guess what? People do that. They have babies. They have grandkids. You know, they perpetuate the species, all right? This is the normal course of life. And when you're absorbed with the normal day-to-day life, day-to-day, you know, subsistence, whatever, you're not watching for it all to end. I mean, this is his point. So for Matthew to really, you know, to really make a good exegetical case that Matthew is thinking about Genesis 6, 1 through 4, you would think he would use the vocabulary that's there, but he doesn't. And he wouldn't muddy the picture by inserting other details. So there's really no clear connection between the two passages. It's one that we sort of read into it because of the marrying and giving in marriage language. But again, that is, he's using vocabulary there that is not found in the Septuagint in Genesis 6, 1 through 4.
Neil has our last question. Today in my devotional, I read about Jesus and Barabbas being like the two goats from the Day of Atonement. Jesus was sacrificed for the sins of the people, and Barabbas was let go. The point was that the two goats had to be the same. Barabbas means son of father, and Messiah means son of God or son of father. I noticed in my NIV Bible calls Barabbas Jesus Barabbas, which makes sense in the context. Pilate asked if he should release Jesus Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Messiah. My question is, why is the NIV the only version that calls him Jesus Barabbas, and all the others just say Barabbas?
All right, this will be like the earlier question. I will get to the question, but I need to make a couple comments prior to this. Barabbas really is not, how can I say this? The wording of the first part of the question doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. How could the different goats, which had different destinies, quote unquote, have to be the same? I don't understand the wording of the question in that regard. You know, if that's what your devotional says, then I think there's a problem with the devotional. Barabbas is not really a good analogy to the goat that is sent away either, because the goat that is sent away either was sent away to its doom. It's sent away to the realm of Satan. Barabbas really wasn't sent to the realm of Satan. He doesn't carry the sins of the people away. I mean, the whole first part of the question to me doesn't make a whole lot of sense as it derives from this devotional. But again, having said that, I felt like I had to say something there. But let's go to the actual question now. Why the NIV, has Jesus Barabbas and the other ones don't? Well, the inclusion or not of Jesus with Barabbas is a text critical issue. What the NIV is doing here is it's adopting a variant, a textual variant, a reading of a manuscript where other translations don't adopt that reading. Now, this will get into the weeds a little bit, but I think people will find it interesting. So in approaching a question like this, I have a Metzger's textual commentary open here, because that's sort of the quickest place to go. If you're not familiar with Metzger's textual commentary, if you know a little bit of Greek, if you've had a year of Greek, let's just say, one of the Greek New Testaments that is used widely in seminary classes is the United Bible Society Greek New Testament, the UBS. Well, when that was, I think it was the third edition, when that came out, Bruce Metzger, who was one of the editors of that edition, also produced a commentary on that edition of the Greek New Testament. Because in that edition of the Greek New Testament, when there's a difference of opinion or an important variant reading from a manuscript, the editors adopted a lettering system, A, B, C, D, to tell the reader, what level of certainty they had when including or excluding something. And so if you go to Matthew 27:16 in Metzger's textual commentary, the Jesus part, that part of a manuscript, Jesus Barabbas, the Jesus part, is given a letter C. And here's what I'm just going to read from Metzger as to what that sort of means to them. He gives you the thinking of the committee, on this. He says, the reading preserved today in several Greek manuscripts and early versions was known to Origen. So Origen, again, is a third century, second, third century early church father. And Origen knew of manuscripts that actually included Jesus Barabbas. Okay, so it's known to Origen, back to Metzger, who declares in his commentary, Origen wrote a commentary on Matthew, quote, in many copies, it is not stated that Barabbas was also called Jesus. And perhaps the omission is right, unquote. Now, Origen discloses in what follows his reason for disapproving of the reading, Jesus Barabbas. He says that it cannot be right, he implies, because, quote, in the whole range of the scriptures, we know that no one who is a sinner is ever called Jesus, unquote. So that's kind of a pastoral homiletical thing on Origen's part. But the important part of the quotation is that Origen knew there were some manuscripts, just a handful, that actually had Jesus Barabbas in them. He, again, didn't prefer those. Metzger says, in a 10th century uncial manuscript, and in about 20 minuscule manuscripts, a marginal comment states, and this is actually a comment that a scribe would have put in the margin, quote, in many ancient copies which I have met with, I found Barabbas himself likewise called Jesus. That is, the question of Pilate stood there as follows, and then he quotes the portion about Jesus Barabbas. For apparently, the paternal name of the robber was Barabbas, which is interpreted son of the teacher, unquote. Now, this comment, which is usually assigned to the manuscripts either to Anastasius, Bishop of Antioch, who lived perhaps the latter part of the 6th century, or to Chrysostom, is in one manuscript attributed to Origen, who may indeed be its ultimate source. That's the end of the Metzger that part of the quote. I'm going to skip to Metzger's conclusion here. He says, a majority of the committee was of the opinion that the original text of Matthew had the double name in both verses, 16 and 17, and that Yesun, Jesus, Jesus, was deliberately suppressed in most textual witnesses for reverential considerations. In view of the relatively slender external support for Jesus in this reading, however, it was deemed fitting to enclose the word within square brackets. And that's what you actually see if you use the UBS, you know, Greek New Testament here. They'll put Jesus in brackets. And so a translator, like someone working on the NIV, would look at that and say, okay, it's in brackets, which means the committee, you know, probably had a disagreement here. They don't feel good enough about the authenticity of Jesus to let it stand and just on its own in the text. And so, you know, what should I do? What should I do? You know, should I include this as part of the translation or not? And so the NIV translator decided to do it. He probably looked into the issue and said, well, you know, it's in a number of early manuscripts. And, you know, Metzger says that it might be original, you know, could be original. I mean, you can build a good case for that. But, you know, scribes later took it out because it just felt icky to put the word, you know, to give Barabbas the name of Jesus. And so we could see them doing that, you know, to quote unquote protect, you know, the name of Jesus. So the NIV translator would think, yeah, you know, I'll go with that. That sounds reasonable, so I'll put it in. But then you have other translators of English Bibles that would say, look, unless I have a high degree of certainty, along with the editors of the Greek New Testament that we're using here for this translation, I'm not putting it in. So that's why one has it and the other doesn't. It's literally a text-critical discussion and decision. Now, I want to say something about the term Barabbas itself, because again, I think people will be interested in this. And my favorite commentary on Matthew is the one by R.T. France in the NIC series. I just like France's work. But he writes this, Barabbas, which is a quote-unquote a common name according to BDAG, which is the standard Greek lexicon for the New Testament, is an Aramaic patronymic, an Aramaic personal name, probably meaning son of Abba, capital A. Abba is found in rabbinic literature both as a name and as a title, meaning father, or it perhaps means son of a teacher, Rabban. Like Rabban would be like rabbi, you know, okay? It's a term that it could actually mean teacher. So the devotional, you know, comment about that it, Barabbas means son of father or son of the father, well, maybe, but it could mean two other things just as legitimately. It could mean son of Abba, some guy named Abba. It could also mean son of a teacher. Now, France references, you know, a pretty exhaustive source on this. Raymond Brown, Father Brown, who is a Catholic New Testament scholar. He's no longer living, but he devoted his scholarly career to the life and times of Jesus. And he's produced some massive works on this. The one I'm going to quote from here is his book, The Death of the Messiah, which is a multi-volume work, but it's just this massive work. It's Yale University Press. And this is going to be from pages 798 through 800, where he comments on Barabbas. He says, Barabbas is a patronymic, in other words, a father's name used to make a distinction among men who bear the same personal names. For instance, among the many men named Jesus in first century AD Palestine, Josephus actually mentions about a dozen people named Jesus. The one of most interest to us would be distinguished as Jesus of or from Nazareth. And if there were several men named Jesus at Nazareth, he would be further identified as Jesus bar Yosef, the son of Joseph. Not infrequently, only the patronymic is used in a description. For example, an 8th century BC Bar Rechuv inscription, and the New Testament Bartholomew and Bartimaeus. More usual is the combination of a personal name with the patronymic. So you have Simon, there's the personal name, and here's the patronymic, Bar Yonah, Simon, son of Jonah. Okay, or Joseph Barnabas, Acts 4:36. You have John's and James, quote, sons of Zebedee, Mark 1:19. So that's what Brown is saying. That's the typical pattern. You'll have a personal name and then some patronymic qualifier, you know, further identification. So then he asks, what was Barabbas's personal name? lesser textual witnesses to Matthew read in verse 16 or verse 17, or in both, Jesus, Barabbas? Is the name Jesus the original reading in either of these Matthew verses? Those who answer no, formerly the majority opinion, point to the tendency of later generations to supply names for those left nameless by the New Testament. The scribes did that. Moreover, the neat pattern in verse 17, Jesus Barabbas, or Jesus who is called Messiah, could reflect a copyist's dramatic touch to heighten the parallelism of the two figures whom Pilate faced. Those who answer yes, though, point out that over against Mark, names are sometimes added or changed in Matthew. For instance, in Mark 9:9, you have Matthew 26:3 and 57 in Matthew, you have Caiaphas. I mean, they're different names interchanged, and they could be the patronymic, they could be the personal name. You know, sometimes we just don't know. So Brown continues, yet if the name Jesus did appear in the original text of Matthew, why would later scribes have omitted it so that it is absent from many important manuscripts? Okay, so he raises the question. Let's see here. He quotes on Origen. Okay, Origen argued defensively, quote, in many copies it is not stated that Barabbas was also called Jesus, unquote. He insisted that it is not proper that the name Jesus be given to an iniquitous person. And since no sinner is ever given the name Jesus elsewhere in scriptures, Origen thought the name might have been added to the Matthean text by heretics. Origen's authority and attitude make it unlikely that Christian scribes of later centuries would have added Jesus to Barabbas' name in Matthew manuscripts that lacked it. Indeed, they would have been encouraged to delete it as an impiety where it already appeared. Yet probably most scholars now argue for the originality of the Jesus Barabbas reading in Matthew, and indeed many go beyond the textual issue to assert that this represents historical tradition lacking in Mark. Now, he goes on one more paragraph here, a more plausible interpretation of the name. Now, he's not dealing here with, you know, how we got it, or is it authentic or not, or original or not. Now he's talking about the interpretation, the meaning. A more plausible interpretation relates Barabbas to Bar-Abba, son of a person named Abba. Abba appears as a personal name with frequency in the Gemara section of the Talmud, which is circa 200 to 400 AD. Then he starts quoting Talmud passages. In one passage, I am looking for Abba. They said to him, there are many Abbas here. He said, I want Abba bar Abba, you know, and so on and so forth. So he gives some citations for people named Abba, again, in literature of 200 to 400 AD, the Talmudic period anyway. And he writes, as he wraps up here, of course, Aramaic Abba means father, as New Testament authors were aware, because of the usage associated with Jesus, for example, Mark 14:36. Accordingly, some scholars think Barabbas did not contain a proper name, but meant son of the father. So that we'll wrap that up as far as Brown goes. So I thought, again, that's a point of curiosity, you know, to end our Q&A here, but it's not a given. It's far from a certainty that Barabbas means son of the father. It could just be a guy named Abba, or again, son of the teacher. And you'd have to, you know, go into, you know, dive into some serious commentaries and probably some journal articles to, you know, to ferret out what difference does it make. Referring back to France, and I actually made, I can't remember what, I have this talk I do on inspiration. And one of the talks I gave on We Need a Better View of Inspiration actually gets into this issue where, you know, whether it's authentic or not, whether it was added by a scribe or not, if you have Jesus Barabbas in the text, it does create some really interesting parallelisms. And it actually becomes part of chiastic structures in Matthew, which Matthew is famous for. The whole book is not only filled with chiasms, it is a chiasm, one huge chiasm. And the, you know, the inclusion of Jesus' name in this passage actually becomes part of one of those chiasms. So it's kind of interesting. I think it's very coherent to argue that, you know, Matthew did this. I mean, that it is original and it is part of a literary presentation to, you know, heighten the tension here, as France said, between these two Jesuses now in front of Pilate, that Matthew included the name deliberately just to, again, make it that much more dramatic in the scene. But anyway, you know, the inclusion or exclusion in an English translation is really, it's basically a text critical decision.
All right, Mike, that's all the questions we have this week. We appreciate you taking the time to answer our questions. And next week we get back into Exodus. What, Exodus 13?
Yep. Yep. Exodus 13, the whole issue of the firstborn, you know, the giving of the firstborn.
All right. Sounds good. Well, we're looking forward to that. All right. Well, we appreciate everybody who sent in their questions and for Mike answering those questions. And I want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.